He didn't seem particularly keen, from all I could hear. And don't you think the fact that he's agreed to meet at all looks like he's got a clear conscience?
No, said Strike. I've told you this before. Plenty of people hang around the likes of me to gauge how the investigation's going. They can't leave well enough alone. They feel compelled to keep explaining themselves.
Need a pee. Hang on. Got more to tell you.
Robin sipped her tomato juice while Strike hobbled away using the new stick. Another flurry of snow passed the window, swiftly dispersing. Robin looked up at the black-and-white photographs opposite and recognized, with a slight shock, Johnny Rokeby, Strike's father. Other than the fact that they were both over 6 feet tall, they did not resemble each other in the slightest. It had taken a DNA test to prove paternity. Strike was listed as one of the rock star's progeny on Rokeby's Wikipedia entry. They had met, so Strike had told Robin, twice. After staring for a while at Rokeby's very tight and revealing leather trousers, Robin forced herself to gaze out of the window again, afraid of Strike catching her staring at his father's groin. Their food arrived as Strike returned to the table.
"The police are searching the whole of Leonora's house now," Strike announced, picking up his knife and fork.
"Why?"
asked Robin, fork suspended in midair.
"Why do you think? Looking for bloody clothing. Checking the garden for freshly dug holes full of her husband's innards. I've put her on to a lawyer. They haven't got enough to arrest her yet, but they're determined to find something."
"You genuinely don't think she did it?"
"No, I don't."
Strike had cleared his plate before he spoke again.
"I'd love to talk to Fancourt. I want to know why he joined Roper Chard when Quine was there and he was supposed to hate him. They'd have been bound to meet."
"You think Fancourt killed Quine so he wouldn't have to meet him at office parties?"
"Good one," said Strike wryly.
He drained his pint glass, picked up his mobile again, dialed directory inquiries, and shortly afterwards was put through to the Elizabeth Tassel Literary Agency. Her assistant Ralph answered. When Strike gave his name, the young man sounded both fearful and excited.
"Oh, I don't know. I'll ask. Putting you on hold."
But he appeared to be less than adept with the telephone system, because after a loud click, the line remained open. Strike could hear a distant Ralph informing his boss that Strike was on the telephone and her loud, impatient retort.
"What the bloody hell does he want now?"
"He didn't say."
Heavy footsteps, the sound of the receiver being snatched off the desk.
"Hello? Elizabeth,"
said Strike pleasantly. "It's me, Cormoran Strike."
"Yes, Ralph just told me. What is it?"
"I was just wondering if we could meet. I'm still working for Leonora Quine. She's convinced that the police suspect her of her husband's murder."
"And what do you want to talk to me for? I can't tell you whether she did or not."
Strike could imagine the shocked faces of Ralph and Sally listening in the smelly old office.
"I've got a few more questions about Quine."
"Oh, for God's sake," growled Elizabeth. "Well, I suppose I could do lunch tomorrow if it suits. Otherwise, I'm busy until..."
"Tomorrow would be great," said Strike. "But it doesn't have to be lunch. I could..."
"Lunch suits me."
"Great," said Strike at once.
"Pescatore, Charlotte Street," she said. 12:30, unless you hear differently."
She rang off.
"They love their bloody lunches, book people," Strike said. "Is it too much of a stretch to think they don't want me at home in case I spot Quine's guts in the freezer?"
Robin's smile faded. "You know, you could lose a friend over this," she said, pulling on her coat, "ringing people up and asking to question them." Strike grunted.
"Don't you care?"
she asked, as they left the warmth for biting cold, snowflakes burning their faces.
"I've got plenty more friends," said Strike, truthfully, without bombast. "We should have a beer every lunchtime," he added,
leaning heavily on his stick as they headed towards the tube, their heads bowed against the white blur.
breaks up the working day.
Robin, who had adjusted her stride to his, smiled. She had enjoyed today more than almost any since she had started work for Strike. But Matthew, still in Yorkshire, helping plan his mother's funeral, must not know about the second trip to a pub in 2 days.
Chapter 27. That I should trust a man whom I had known betray his friend. William Congreve, the Double Dealer. An immense carpet of snow was rolling down over Britain. The morning news showed the northeast of England already buried in powdery whiteness, cars stranded like so many hapless sheep, headlamps feebly glinting. London waited its turn beneath an increasingly ominous sky, and Strike, glancing at the weather map on his TV as he dressed, wondered whether his drive to Devon the next day would be possible, whether the M5 would be even navigable. Determined though he was to meet the incapacitated Daniel Chard, whose invitation struck him as highly peculiar, he dreaded driving even an automatic with his leg in this condition. The dogs would still be out on mucking marshes. He imagined them as he attached the prosthesis, his knee puffier and more painful than ever, their sensitive quivering noses probing the freshest patches of landfill under these threatening gunmetal clouds beneath circling seagulls. They might already have started, given the limited daylight, dragging their handlers through the frozen garbage, searching for Owen Quine's guts. Strike had worked alongside sniffer dogs. Their wriggling rumps and wagging tails always added an incongruously cheerful note to searches. He was disconcerted by how painful it was to walk downstairs. Of course, in an ideal world he would have spent the previous day with an ice pack pressed to the end of his stump, his leg elevated, not tramping all over London because he needed to stop himself thinking about Charlotte and her wedding, soon to take place in the restored chapel of the Castle of Croy, not Croy Castle, because it annoys the fucking family. 9 days to go. The telephone rang on Robin's desk as he unlocked the glass door. Wincing, he hurried to get it. The suspicious lover and boss of Miss Brocklehurst wished to inform Strike that his PA was at home in his bed with a bad cold, so he was not to be charged for surveillance until she was up and about again. Strike had barely replaced the receiver when it rang again. Another client, Caroline Ingalls, announced in a voice throbbing with emotion that she and her errant husband had reconciled. Strike was offering insincere congratulations when Robin arrived, pink-faced with cold.
"It's getting worse out there," she said when he had hung up. "Who was that?"
"Caroline Ingalls. She's made up with Rupert."
"What?" said Robin, stunned. "After all those lap dances?"
"They're going to work on their marriage for the sake of the kids."
Robin made a little snort of disbelief.
"Snow looks bad up in Yorkshire," Strike commented. "If you want to take tomorrow off and leave early..."
"No,"
said Robin. "I put myself on the Friday night sleeper. I should be fine.
If we've lost Ingalls, I could call one of the waiting list clients..."
"Not yet,"
said Strike, slumping down on the sofa and unable to stop his hand sliding to his swollen knee as it protested painfully.
"Is it still sore?"
Robin asked diffidently, pretending she had not seen him wince.
"Yeah," said Strike. "But that's not why I don't want to take on another client," he added sharply.
"I know,"
said Robin, who had her back to him, switching on the kettle. "You want to concentrate on the Quine case?" Strike was not sure whether her tone was reproachful.
"She'll pay me," he said shortly. "Quine had life insurance. She made him take it out. So there's money there now."
Robin heard his defensiveness and did not like it. Strike was making the assumption that her priority was money. Hadn't she proved that it was not when she had turned down much better paid jobs to work for him? Hadn't he noticed the willingness with which she was trying to help him prove that Leonora Quine had not killed her husband? She set a mug of tea, a glass of water,
and paracetamol down beside him. "Thanks," he said through gritted teeth, irritated by the painkillers, even though he intended to take a double dose. "I'll book a taxi to take you to Pescatore at 12, shall I?"
"It's only around the corner," he said.
"You know, there's pride and then there's stupidity," said Robin, with one of the first flashes of real temper he had ever seen in her.
"Fine," he said, eyebrows raised. "I'll take a bloody taxi."
And in truth, he was glad of it 3 hours later as he limped, leaning heavily on the cheap stick, which was now warping from his weight, to the taxi waiting at the end of Denmark Street. He knew now that he ought not to have put on the prosthesis at all. Getting out of the cab a few minutes later in Charlotte Street was tricky, the taxi driver impatient. Strike reached the noisy warmth of Pescatore with relief. Elizabeth was not yet there, but had booked under her name. Strike was shown to a table for two beside a pebble-set and whitewashed wall. Rustic wooden beams crisscrossed the ceiling. A rowing boat was suspended over the bar. Across the opposite wall were jaunty orange leather booths. From force of habit, Strike ordered a pint, enjoying the light, bright Mediterranean charm of his surroundings, watching the snow drifting past the windows. The agent arrived not long afterwards. He tried to stand as she approached the table, but fell back down again quickly. Elizabeth did not seem to notice. She looked as though she had lost weight since he had last seen her. The well-cut black suit, the scarlet lipstick and a steel-grey bob did not lend her dash today, but looked like a badly chosen disguise. Her face was yellowish and seemed to sag.
"How are you?" he asked.
"How do you think I am?"
she croaked rudely.
"What?"
she snapped at a hovering waiter.
"Oh, water, still."
She picked up her menu with an air of having given away too much, and Strike could tell that any expression of pity or concern would be unwelcome.
"Just soup,"
she told the waiter when he returned for their order.
"I appreciate you seeing me again," Strike said when the waiter had departed.
"Well, God knows Leonora needs all the help she can get,"
said Elizabeth.
"Why do you say that?"
Elizabeth narrowed her eyes at him.
"Don't pretend to be stupid. She told me she insisted on being brought to Scotland Yard to see you, right after she got the news about Owen."
"Yeah, she did."
"And how did she think that would look? The police probably expected her to collapse in a heap, and all she wants to do is see her detective friend."
She suppressed a cough with difficulty.
"I don't think Leonora gives any thought to the impression she makes on other people," said Strike.
No, well, you're right there. She's never been the brightest."
Strike wondered what impression Elizabeth Tassel thought she made on the world, whether she realized how little she was liked. She allowed the cough that she had been trying to suppress free expression, and he waited for the loud, seal-like barks to pass before asking,
"You think she should have faked some grief?"
"I don't say it's fake," snapped Elizabeth. "I'm sure she is upset in her own limited way. I'm just saying it wouldn't hurt to play the grieving widow a bit more. It's what people expect."
"I suppose you've talked to the police."
"Of course. We've been through the row in the River Cafe over and over, the reason I didn't read the damn book properly. And they wanted to know my movements after I last saw Owen. Specifically, the 3 days after I saw him."
She glared interrogatively at Strike, whose expression remained impassive.
"I take it they think he died within 3 days of our argument?"
"I've no idea," lied Strike. "What did you tell him about your movements?"
"That I went straight home after Owen stormed out on me, got up at 6 next morning, took a taxi to Paddington, and went to stay with Dorcas."
"One of your writers, I think you said."
"Yes, Dorcas Pengelly. She..."
Elizabeth noticed Strike's small grin, and for the first time in their acquaintance, her face relaxed into a fleeting smile.
"It's her real name. If you can believe it, not a pseudonym. She writes pornography dressed up as historical romance. Owen was very sniffy about her books, but he'd have killed for her sales. They go, said Elizabeth, like hot cakes.
When did you get back from Dorcas's?
Late Monday afternoon. It was supposed to be a nice long weekend, but nice, said Elizabeth tensely. Thanks to Bombix Morrie, it was not. I live alone, she continued. I can't prove I went home, that I didn't murder Owen as soon as I got back to London. I certainly felt like doing it.
She drank more water and continued.
The police were mostly interested in the book. They seem to think it's given a lot of people a motive.
It was her first overt attempt to get information out of him.
It looked like a lot of people at first, said Strike. But if they've got the time of death right and Quine died within 3 days of your row in the River Cafe, the number of suspects will be fairly limited.
How so? Said Elizabeth sharply.
And he was reminded of one of his most scathing tutors at Oxford, who used this two-word question like a giant needle to puncture ill-founded theorizing.
Can't give you that information, I'm afraid, Strike replied pleasantly. Mustn't prejudice the police case.
Her pallid skin across the small table was large-pored and coarse-grained, the olive-dark eyes watchful.
They asked me, she said, to whom I had shown the manuscript during the few days I had it before sending it to Jerry and Christian. Answer? Nobody. And they asked me with whom Owen discusses his manuscripts while he's writing them. I don't know why that was, she said,
her black eyes still fixed on Strike's.
Do they think somebody egged him on?
I don't know, Strike lied again. Does he discuss the books he's working on?
He might have confided bits in Jerry Waldegrave. He barely deigned to tell me his titles.
Really? He never asked your advice. Did you say you'd studied English at Oxford?
I took a first, she said angrily. But that counted for less than nothing with Owen, who incidentally was thrown off his course at Loughborough, or some such place, and never got a degree at all. Yes, and Michael once kindly told Owen that I'd been lamentably derivative as a writer back when we were students, and Owen never forgot it.
The memory of the old slight had given a purple tinge to her yellowish skin.
Owen shared Michael's prejudice about women in literature. Neither of them minded women praising their work, of course.
She coughed into her napkin and emerged red-faced and angry.
Owen was a bigger glutton for praise than any author I've ever met, and they are most of them insatiable.
Their food arrived. Tomato and basil soup for Elizabeth, and cod and chips for Strike.
You told me when we last met, said Strike, having swallowed his first large mouthful, that there came a point when you had to choose between Fancourt and Quine. Why did you choose Quine?
She was blowing on a spoonful of soup and seemed to give her answer serious consideration before speaking.
I felt, at that time, that he was more sinned against than sinning.
Did this have something to do with the parody somebody wrote of Fancourt's wife's novel?
Somebody didn't write it, she said quietly. Owen did.
Do you know that for sure?
He showed it to me before he sent it to the magazine. I'm afraid.
Elizabeth met Strike's gaze with cold defiance.
It made me laugh. It was painfully accurate and very funny. Owen was always a good literary mimic.
But then Fancourt's wife killed herself.
Which was a tragedy, of course,
said Elizabeth, without noticeable emotion.
Although nobody could have reasonably expected it. Frankly, anybody who's going to kill themselves because of a bad review has no business writing a novel in the first place. But, naturally enough, Michael was livid with Owen, and I think the more so because Owen got cold feet and denied authorship once he heard about Elspeth's suicide. It was, perhaps, a surprisingly cowardly attitude for a man who liked to be thought of as fearless and lawless. Michael wanted me to drop Owen as a client. I refused. Michael hasn't spoken to me since.
Was Quine making more money for you than Fancourt at the time? Strike asked.
Good God, no,
she said.
It wasn't to my pecuniary advantage to stick with Owen.
Then why?
I've just told you,
she said impatiently.
I believe in freedom of speech, up to and including upsetting people. Anyway, days after Elspeth killed herself, Leonora gave birth to premature twins. Something went badly wrong at the birth. The boy died, and Orlando is... I take it you've met her by now?
As he nodded, Strike's dream of the other night came back to him suddenly. The baby that Charlotte had given birth to, but that she would not let him see.
Brain damaged,
Elizabeth went on.
So Owen was going through his own personal tragedy at the time, and unlike Michael, he hadn't brought any of it on himself.
Coughing again, she caught Strike's look of faint surprise and made an impatient staying gesture with her hand, indicating that she would explain when the fit had passed. Finally, after another sip of water, she croaked.
Michael only encouraged Elspeth to write to keep her out of his hair while he worked. They had nothing in common. He married her because he's terminally touchy about being lower middle class. She was an earl's daughter who thought marrying Michael would mean non-stop literary parties and sparkling intellectual chat. She didn't realize she'd be alone most of the time while Michael worked. She was, said Elizabeth with disdain, a woman of few resources. But she got excited at the idea of being a writer. Have you any idea,
said the agent harshly,
how many people think they can write? You cannot imagine the crap I am sent day in, day out. Elspeth's novel would have been rejected out of hand under normal circumstances. It was so pretentious and silly. But they weren't normal circumstances. Having encouraged her to produce the damn thing, Michael didn't have the balls to tell her it was awful. He gave it to his publisher, and they took it to keep Michael happy. It had been out a week when the parody appeared.
Quine implies in Bombyx Mori that Fancourt really wrote the parody, said Strike.
I know he does. And I wouldn't want to provoke Michael Fancourt,
she added in an apparent aside that begged to be heard.
What do you mean?
There was a short pause in which he could almost see Elizabeth deciding what to tell him.
I met Michael,
she said slowly,
in a tutorial group studying Jacobean revenge tragedies. Let's just say it was his natural milieu. He adores those writers, their sadism and their lust for revenge, rape and cannibalism, poison skeletons dressed up as women, sadistic retribution is Michael's obsession.
She glanced up at Strike, who was watching her.
What?
She said curtly. When, he wondered, were the details of Quine's murder going to explode across the newspapers? The dam must already be straining with Culpepper on the case. Did Fancourt take sadistic retribution when you chose Quine over him? She looked down at the bowl of red liquid and pushed it abruptly away from her.
We were close friends, very close. But he's never said a word to me from the day that I refused to sack Owen. He did his best to warn other writers away from my agency. Said I was a woman of no honour or principle. But I hold one principle sacred, and he knew it,
she said firmly.
Owen hadn't done anything in writing that parody that Michael hadn't done 100 times to other writers. Of course I regretted the aftermath deeply, but it was one of the times, the few times, when I felt that Owen was morally in the clear.
Must have hurt, though, Strike said. You'd known Fancourt longer than Quine.
We've been enemies longer than we've been friends now.
It was not, Strike noted, a proper answer.
You mustn't think... Owen wasn't always... He wasn't all bad,
Elizabeth said restlessly.
You know, he was obsessed with virility, in life and in his work. Sometimes it was a metaphor for creative genius, but at other times it's seen as the bar to artistic fulfillment. The plot of Hobart's Sin turns on Hobart, who's both male and female, having to choose between parenthood and abandoning his aspirations as a writer, aborting his baby or abandoning his brainchild. But when it came to fatherhood in real life, you understand Orlando wasn't. You wouldn't have chosen your child to... But he loved her, and she loved him.
Except for the times he walked out on the family to consort with mistresses or fritter away money in hotel rooms, suggested Strike.
All right, he wouldn't have won Father of the Year,
snapped Elizabeth.
But there was love there.
A silence fell over the table, and Strike decided not to break it. He was sure that Elizabeth Tassel had agreed to this meeting, as she had requested the last, for reasons of her own, and he was keen to hear them. He therefore ate his fish and waited.
The police have asked me,
she said finally, when his plate was almost clear,
whether Owen was blackmailing me in some way.
Really? Said Strike. The restaurant clattered and chattered around them, and outside the snow fell thicker than ever. Here again was the familiar phenomenon of which he had spoken to Robin. The suspect who wished to re-explain, worried that they had not made a good enough job of it on their first attempt.
They've taken note of the large dollops of money passing from my account to Owen's over the years, said Elizabeth.
Strike said nothing. Her ready payment of Quine's hotel bills had struck him as out of character in their previous meeting.
What do they think anyone could blackmail me for?
She asked him, with a twist to her scarlet mouth.
My professional life has been scrupulously honest. I have no private life to speak of. I am the very definition of a blameless spinster, aren't I?
Strike, who judged it impossible to answer such a question, however rhetorical, without giving offence, said nothing.
It started when Orlando was born,
Elizabeth said.
Owen had managed to get through all the money he'd ever made, and Leonora was in intensive care for 2 weeks after the birth, and Michael Fancourt was screaming to anybody who'd listen that Owen had murdered his wife. Owen was a pariah. Neither he nor Leonora had any family. I lent him money as a friend to get baby things. Then I advanced him money for a mortgage on a bigger house. Then there was money for specialists to look at Orlando when it was clear that she wasn't developing quite as she should, and therapists to help her. Before I knew it, I was the family's personal bank. Every time royalties came in, Owen would make a big fuss about repaying me, and sometimes I'd get a few thousand back. At heart, said the agent, the words tumbling out of her, Owen was an overgrown child, which could make him unbearable or charming, irresponsible, impulsive, egotistical, amazingly lacking in conscience, but he could also be fun, enthusiastic, and engaging. There was a pathos, a funny fragility about him, however badly he behaved, that made people feel protective. Jerry Waldegrave felt it, women felt it, I felt it. And the truth is that I kept on hoping, even believing, that one day he'd produce another Hobart Sin. There was always something in every bloody awful book he's written, something that meant you couldn't completely write him off.
A waiter came over to take away their plates. Elizabeth waved away his solicitous inquiry as to whether there had been something wrong with her soup and asked for a coffee. Strike accepted the offer of the dessert menu.
Orlando's sweet, though,
Elizabeth added gruffly.
Orlando's very sweet.
Yeah. She seemed to think, said Strike, watching her closely,
that she saw you going into Quine's study the other day, while Leonora was in the bathroom.
He did not think that she had expected the question, nor did she seem to like it.
She saw that, did she?
She sipped water, hesitated, then said,
I challenge anyone depicted in Bombyx Mori, given the chance of seeing what other nasty jottings Owen might have left lying around, not to take the opportunity of having a look.
Did you find anything?
No, she said, because the place was a tip. I could see immediately that it would take far too long to search, and...
She raised her chin defiantly.
To be absolutely frank, I didn't want to leave fingerprints. So I left as quickly as I walked in. It was the possibly ignoble impulse of a moment.
She seemed to have said everything she had come to say. Strike ordered an apple and strawberry crumble and took the initiative.
Daniel Chard wants to see me, he told her.
Her olive-dark eyes widened in surprise.
Why?
I don't know. Unless the snow's too bad, I'm going down to visit him in Devon tomorrow. I'd like to know, before I meet him, why he's portrayed as the murderer of a young blonde man in Bombyx Mori.
I'm not providing a key to that filthy book for you, retorted Elizabeth, with a return of all her former aggression and suspicion. No, not doing it.
That's a shame, said Strike, because people are talking.
Am I likely to compound my own egregious mistake in sending the damn thing out into the world by gossiping about it?
I'm discreet, Strike assured her. Nobody needs to know where I got my information.
But she merely glanced at him, cold and impassive. What about Catherine Kent?
What about her?
Why is the cave of her lair in Bombyx Mori full of rat skulls?
Elizabeth said nothing.
I know Catherine Kent's harpy. I've met her, said Strike patiently. All you're doing by explaining is saving me some time. I suppose you want to find out who killed Quine.
So bloody transparent, she said witheringly. Does that usually work on people?
Yeah, he said matter-of-factly. It does.
She frowned, then said abruptly, and not altogether to his surprise,
Well, after all, I don't owe Catherine Kent any loyalty. If you must know, Owen was making a fairly crude reference to the fact that she works at an animal testing facility. They do disgusting things there to rats, dogs, and monkeys. I heard all about it at one of the parties Owen brought her to. There she was, falling out of her dress and trying to impress me,
said Elizabeth with contempt.
I've seen her work. She makes Dorcas Pengelly look like Iris Murdoch. Typical of the dross. The dross.
Strike managed several mouthfuls of his crumble while she coughed hard into her napkin.
The dross the internet has given us, she finished, her eyes watering. And, almost worse, she seemed to expect me to be on her side against the scruffy students who attacked their laboratories. I'm a vet's daughter. I grew up with animals, and I like them much better than I like people. I found Catherine Kent a horrible person.
Any idea who Harpy's daughter Epicene's supposed to be? Asked Strike.
No,
said Elizabeth.
Or the dwarf in the cutter's bag.
I'm not explaining any more of the wretched book.
Do you know if Quine knew a woman called Pipper?
I never met a Pipper. But he taught creative writing courses, middle-aged women trying to find their raison d'etre. That's where he picked up Catherine Kent.
She sipped her coffee and glanced at her watch.
What can you tell me about Joe North? Strike asked.
She glanced at him suspiciously.
Why?
Curious, said Strike.
He did not know why she chose to answer, perhaps because North was long dead, or because of that streak of sentimentality he had at first divined back in her cluttered office.
"He was from California," she said. "He'd come over to London to find his English roots. He was gay, a few years younger than Michael, Owen, and me, and writing a very frank first novel about the life he'd led in San Francisco. Michael introduced me to him. Michael thought his stuff was first class, and it was, but he wasn't a fast writer. He was partying hard, and also, which none of us knew for a couple of years, he was HIV positive and not looking after himself. There came a point when he developed full-blown AIDS."
Elizabeth cleared her throat.
"Well, you'll remember how much hysteria there was about HIV when it first emerged."
Strike was inured to people thinking that he was at least 10 years older than he was. In fact, he had heard from his mother, never one to guard her tongue in deference to a child's sensibilities, about the killer disease that was stalking those who fucked freely and shared needles.
"Joe fell apart physically, and all the people who'd wanted to know him when he was promising, clever and beautiful melted away, except, to do them credit," said Elizabeth grudgingly, "Michael and Owen. They rallied round Joe, but he died with his novel unfinished. Michael was ill and couldn't go to Joe's funeral, but Owen was a pallbearer. In gratitude for the way they'd looked after him, Joe left the pair of them that rather lovely house where they'd once parted and sat up all night discussing books. I was there for a few of those evenings. They were happy times," said Elizabeth.
"How much did they use the house after North died?"
"I can't answer for Michael, but I doubt he's been there since he fell out with Owen, which was not long after Joe's funeral,"
said Elizabeth with a shrug.
"Owen never went there because he was terrified of running into Michael. The terms of Joe's will were peculiar. I think they call it a restrictive covenant. Joe stipulated that the house was to be preserved as an artist's refuge. That's how Michael's managed to block the sale all these years. The Quines have never managed to find another artist or artists to sell to. A sculptor rented it for a while, but that didn't work out. Of course, Michael's always been as picky as possible about tenants to stop Owen benefiting financially, and he can afford lawyers to enforce his whims."
"What happened to North's unfinished book?" asked Strike.
"Oh, Michael abandoned work on his own novel and finished Joe's posthumously. It's called Towards the Mark, and Harold Weaver published it. It's a cult classic, never been out of print."
She checked her watch again.
"I need to go," she said. "I've got a meeting at 2:30. My coat, please,"
she called to a passing waiter.
"Somebody told me," said Strike, who remembered perfectly well that it had been Anstice, "that you supervised work on Talgarth Road a while back."
"Yes," she said indifferently. "Just one more of the unusual jobs Quine's agent ended up doing for him. It was a matter of coordinating repairs, putting in workmen. I sent Michael a bill for half, and he paid up through his lawyers."
"You had a key?"
"Which I passed to the foreman," she said coldly, "then returned to the Quines."
"You didn't go and see the work yourself?"
"Of course I did. I needed to check it had been done. I think I visited twice."
"Was hydrochloric acid used in any of the renovation, do you know?"
"The police asked me about hydrochloric acid," she said. "Why?"
"I can't say."
She glowered. He doubted that people often refused Elizabeth Tassel information.
"Well, I can only tell you what I told the police. It was probably left there by Todd Harkness."
"Who?"
"The sculptor I told you about who rented the studio space. Owen found him, and Fancourt's lawyers couldn't find a reason to object. What nobody realized was that Harkness worked mainly in rusted metal, and used some very corrosive chemicals. He did a lot of damage in the studio before being asked to leave. Fancourt's side did that clean-up operation and sent us the bill."
The waiter had brought her coat, to which a few dog hairs clung. Strike could hear a faint whistle from her labouring chest as she stood up. With a peremptory shake of the hand, Elizabeth Tassel left. Strike took another taxi back to the office with the vague intention of being conciliatory to Robin. Somehow they had rubbed each other up the wrong way that morning, and he was not quite sure how it had happened. However, by the time he had finally reached the outer office, he was sweating with the pain in his knee, and Robin's first words drove all thought of propitiation from his mind. "The car hire company just called. They haven't got an automatic, but they can give you..." "It's got to be an automatic," snapped Strike, dropping onto the sofa in an eruption of leathery flatulence that irritated him still further. "I can't bloody drive a manual in this state. Have you rung?"
"Of course I've tried other places," said Robin coldly. "I've tried everywhere. Nobody can give you an automatic tomorrow. The weather forecast's atrocious anyway. I think you'd do better to..."
"I'm going to interview Chard," said Strike.
Pain and fear were making him angry. Fear that he would have to give up the prosthesis and resort to crutches again, his trouser leg pinned up, staring eyes, pity. He hated hard plastic chairs in disinfected corridors, hated his voluminous notes being unearthed and pored over, murmurs about changes to his prosthesis, advice from calm medical men to rest, to mollycoddle his leg as though it were a sick child he had to carry everywhere with him. In his dreams, he was not one-legged. In his dreams, he was whole. Chard's invitation had been an unlooked-for gift. He intended to seize it. There were many things he wanted to ask Quine's publisher. The invitation itself was glaringly strange. He wanted to hear Chard's reason for dragging him to Devon.
"Did you hear me?" asked Robin.
"What?"
"I said I could drive you."
"No, you can't," said Strike ungraciously.
"Why not?"
"You got to be in Yorkshire."
"I've got to be at King's Cross tomorrow night at 11.
The snow's going to be terrible."
"We'll set out early. Or," said Robin with a shrug, "you can cancel, Chard. But the forecast for next week's awful too."
It was difficult to reverse from ingratitude to the opposite with Robin's steely grey blue eyes upon him.
"All right," he said stiffly. "Thanks."
"Then I need to go and pick up the car," said Robin.
"Right," said Strike through gritted teeth.
Owen Quine had not thought women had any place in literature. He, Strike, had a secret prejudice too. But what choice did he have, with his knee screaming for mercy and no automatic car for hire?
Chapter 28. That, of all other, was the most fatal and dangerous exploit that I ever was ranged in since I first bore arms before the face of the enemy. Ben Jonson, Every Man in His Humour. At 5 o'clock the following morning, a muffled and gloved Robin boarded one of the first tube trains of the day, her hair glistening with snowflakes, a small backpack over her shoulder, and carrying a weekend bag into which she had packed the black dress, coat and shoes that she would need for Mrs. Cunliffe's funeral. She did not dare count on getting back home after the round trip to Devon, but intended to go straight to King's Cross once she had returned the car to the hire company. Sitting on the almost empty train, she consulted her own feelings about the day ahead and found them mixed. Excitement was her dominant emotion, because she was convinced that Strike had some excellent reason for interviewing Chard that could not wait. Robin had learned to trust her boss's judgment and his hunches. It was one of the things that so irritated Matthew.
Matthew.
Robin's black-gloved fingers tightened on the handle of the bag beside her. She kept lying to Matthew. Robin was a truthful person, and never, in the 9 years that they had been together, had she lied. Or not until recently. Some had been lies of omission. Matthew had asked her on the telephone on Wednesday night what she had done at work that day, and she had given him a brief and heavily edited version of her activities, omitting her trip with Strike to the house where Quine had been murdered, lunch at the Albion, and, of course, the walk across the bridge at West Brompton Station, with Strike's heavy arm over her shoulder. But there had been outright lies, too. Just last night he had asked her, like Strike, whether she oughtn't take the day off, get an earlier train. "I tried," she had said, the lie sliding easily from her lips before she considered it. "They're all full. It's the weather, isn't it? I suppose people are taking the train instead of risking it in their cars. I'll just have to stick with a sleeper." What else could I say? Thought Robin, as the dark windows reflected her own tense face back to her. He'd have gone ballistic. The truth was that she wanted to go to Devon. She wanted to help Strike. She wanted to get out from behind her computer, however much quiet satisfaction her competent administration of the business gave her, and investigate. Was that wrong? Matthew thought so. It wasn't what he'd counted on. He had wanted her to go with the advertising agency into human resources at nearly twice the salary. London was so expensive, Matthew wanted a bigger flat. He was, she supposed, carrying her. Then there was Strike. A familiar frustration, a tight knot in her stomach. "We'll have to get someone else in." Constant mentions of this prospective partner, who was assuming mythical substance in Robin's mind. A short-haired, shrew-faced woman, like the police officer who had stood guard outside the crime scene in Talgarth Road. She would be competent and trained in all the ways Robin was not, and unencumbered. For the very first time, in this half-empty, brightly lit tube carriage, with the world dark outside and her ears full of rumble and clatter, she said it openly to herself. By a fiancé like Matthew. But Matthew was the axis of her life, the fixed centre. She loved him. She had always loved him. He had stuck with her through the worst time in her life, when many young men would have left. She wanted to marry him, and she was going to marry him. It was just that they had never had fundamental disagreements before, never. Something about her job, her decision to stay with Strike, about Strike himself, had introduced a rogue element into their relationship, something threatening and new. The Toyota Land Cruiser that Robin had hired had been parked overnight in the Kew Park in Chinatown, one of the nearest car parks to Denmark Street, where there was no parking at all. Slipping and sliding in her flattest smart shoes, the weekend bag swinging from her right hand, Robin hurried through the darkness to the multi-story, refusing to think any more about Matthew, or what he would think or say if he could see her, heading off for 6 hours alone in the car with Strike. After placing her bag in the boot, Robin sat back in the driver's seat, set up the sat-nav, adjusted the heating, and left the engine running to warm up the icy interior. Strike was a little late, which was unlike him. Robin whiled away the wait by acquainting herself fully with the controls. She loved cars, had always loved driving. By the age of 10, she had been able to drive the tractor on her uncle's farm as long as someone helped her release the handbrake. Unlike Matthew, she had passed her test the first time. She had learned not to tease him about this. Movement glimpsed in her rearview mirror made her look up. A dark-suited Strike was making his way laboriously towards the car on crutches, his right trouser leg pinned up. Robin felt a sick, swooping feeling in the pit of her stomach. Not because of the amputated leg, which she had seen before, and in much more troubling circumstances, but because it was the first time that she had known Strike forsake the prosthesis in public. She got out of the car, then wished she hadn't when she caught his scowl. "Good thinking getting a 4x4," he said, silently warning her not to talk about his leg. "Yeah, I thought we'd better in this weather," said Robin. He moved around to the passenger seat. Robin knew she must not offer help. She could feel an exclusion zone around him as though he were telepathically rejecting all offers of assistance or sympathy. But she was worried that he would not be able to get inside unaided. Strike threw his crutches onto the back seat and stood for a moment precariously balanced. Then, with a show of upper body strength that she had never seen before, pulled himself smoothly into the car. Robin jumped back in hastily, closed the door, put her seatbelt on and reversed out of the parking space. Strike's preemptive rejection of her concern sat like a wall between them, and to her sympathy was added a twist of resentment that he would not let her in to that tiny degree. When had she ever fussed over him or tried to mother him? The most she had ever done was pass him paracetamol. Strike knew himself to be unreasonable, but the awareness merely increased his irritation. On waking, it had been obvious that to try to force the prosthesis onto his leg when the knee was hot, swollen, and extremely painful would be an act of idiocy. He had been forced to descend the metal stairs on his backside, like a small child. Traversing Charing Cross Road on ice and crutches had earned him the stares of those few early morning pedestrians who were braving the sub-zero darkness. He had never wanted to return to this state, but here he was, all because of a temporary forgetfulness that he was not, like the dream strike, whole. At least, Strike noted with relief, Robin could drive. His sister, Lucy, was distractible and unreliable behind the wheel. Charlotte had always driven her Lexus in a manner that caused Strike physical pain, speeding through red lights, turning up one-way streets, smoking and chatting on her mobile, narrowly missing cyclists and the opening doors of parked cars. Ever since the Viking had blown up around him on that yellow dirt road, Strike had found it difficult to be driven by anyone except a professional. After a long silence, Robin said, "There's coffee in the backpack."
"What?"
"In the backpack, a flask. I didn't think we should stop unless we really have to. And there are biscuits." The windscreen wipers were carving their way through flecks of snow.
"You're a bloody marvel," said Strike, his reserve crumbling.
He had not had breakfast. Trying and failing to attach his false leg, finding a pin for his suit trousers, digging out his crutches and getting himself downstairs had taken twice the time he had allowed. And in spite of herself, Robin gave a small smile. Strike poured himself coffee and ate several bits of shortbread, his appreciation of Robin's deft handling of the strange car increasing as his hunger decreased.
"What does Matthew drive?" he asked as they sped over the Boston Manor Viaduct.
"Nothing," said Robin. "We haven't got a car in London."
"Yeah, no need," said Strike,
privately reflecting that if he ever gave Robin the salary she deserved, they might be able to afford one. "So what are you planning to ask Daniel Chard?" Robin asked.
"Plenty," said Strike, brushing crumbs off his dark jacket. "First off, whether he's fallen out with Quine, and if so, what about? I can't fathom why Quine, total dickhead though he clearly was, decided to attack the man who had his livelihood in his hands and who had the money to sue him into oblivion."
Strike munched shortbread for a while, swallowed, then added,
"Unless Jerry Waldegrave's right, and Quine was having a genuine breakdown when he wrote it and lashed out at anyone he thought he could blame for his lousy sales."
Robin, who had finished reading Bombick's Morrie while Strike had been having lunch with Elizabeth Tassel the previous day, said, "Isn't the writing too coherent for somebody having a breakdown?"
"The syntax might be sound, but I don't think you'd find many people who disagree that the content's bloody insane."
"His other writing's very like it."
"None of his other stuff's as crazy as Bombick's Morrie," said Strike. "Hobart Sin and the Balzac brothers both had plots."
"This has got a plot."
"Has it? Or is Bombick's his little walking tour just a convenient way of stringing together a load of attacks on different people?"
The snow fell thick and fast as they passed the exit to Heathrow, talking about the novel's various grotesqueries, laughing a little over its ludicrous jumps of logic, its absurdities. The trees on either side of the motorway looked as though they had been dusted with tons of icing sugar.
"Maybe Quine was born 400 years too late," said Strike, still eating shortbread. "Elizabeth Tassel told me there's a Jacobean revenge play featuring a poisoned skeleton disguised as a woman. Presumably someone shags it and dies.
not a million miles away from Phallus Impudicus getting ready to—
Don't, said Robin, with a half laugh and a shudder. But Strike had not broken off because of her protest, or because of any sense of repugnance. Something had flickered deep in his subconscious as he spoke. Somebody had told him. Someone had said. But the memory was gone in a flash of tantalizing silver, like a minnow vanishing in pondweed.
A poison skeleton, Strike muttered, trying to capture the elusive memory, but it was gone.
And I finished Hobart Sin last night as well, said Robin, overtaking a dawdling Prius.
You're a sucker for punishment, said Strike, reaching for a sixth biscuit. I didn't think you were enjoying it.
I wasn't, and it didn't improve.
It's all about a hermaphrodite who's pregnant and gets an abortion because a kid would interfere with his literary ambitions, said Strike.
You've read it?
No, Elizabeth Tassel told me.
There's a bloody sack in it, said Robin. Strike looked sideways at her pale profile, serious as she watched the road ahead, her eyes flicking to the rearview mirror.
What's inside?
The aborted baby, said Robin. It's horrible.
Strike digested this information as they passed the turning to Maidenhead.
Strange, he said at last.
Grotesque, said Robin.
No, it's strange, insisted Strike. Quine was repeating himself. That's the second thing from Hobart Sin he put in Bombix Mori. Two hermaphrodites, two bloody sacks.
Why?
Well, said Robin, they aren't exactly the same. In Bombix Mori, the bloody sack doesn't belong to the hermaphrodite, and it hasn't got an aborted baby in it. Maybe he'd reached the end of his invention, she said. Maybe Bombix Mori was like a final bonfire of all his ideas.
The funeral pyre for his career is what it was.
Strike sat deep in thought while the scenery beyond the window became steadily more rural. Breaks in the trees showed wide fields of snow, white upon white beneath a pearly grey sky, and still the snow came thick and fast at the car.
You know, Strike said at last, I think there are two alternatives here. Either Quine genuinely was having a breakdown, had lost touch with what he was doing and believed Bombix Mori was a masterpiece, or he meant to cause as much trouble as possible, and the duplications are there for a reason.
What reason?
It's a key, said Strike. By cross-referencing with other books, he was helping people understand what he was getting at in Bombix Mori. He was trying to tell without being had up for libel.
Robin did not take her eyes off the snowy motorway, but inclined her face towards him, frowning.
You think it was all totally deliberate? You think he wanted to cause all this trouble?
When you stop and think about it, said Strike, it's not a bad business plan for an egotistical, thick-skinned man who's hardly selling any books. Kick off as much trouble as you can, get the book gossiped about all over London, threats of legal action, loads of people upset, veiled revelations about a famous writer, and then disappear where the Ritz can't find you, and before anyone can stop you, put it out as an e-book.
But he was furious when Elizabeth Tassel told him she wouldn't publish it.
Was he? Said Strike thoughtfully. Or was he faking? Did he keep badgering her to read it because he was getting ready to stage a nice big public row? He sounds like a massive exhibitionist. Perhaps it was all part of his promotional plan. He didn't think Roper Chard got his books enough publicity. I had that from Leonora.
So you think he'd already planned to storm out of the restaurant when he met Elizabeth Tassel?
Could be, said Strike.
And to go to Talgarth Road?
Maybe.
The sun had risen fully now, so that the frosted treetops sparkled.
And he got what he wanted, didn't he?
Said Strike, squinting as a thousand specks of ice glittered over the windscreen. Couldn't have arranged better publicity for his book if he'd tried.
Just a pity he didn't live to see himself on the BBC News.
Oh, bollocks,
he added under his breath.
What's the matter?
I've finished all the biscuits. Sorry, said Strike, contrite.
That's all right, said Robin, amused. I had breakfast.
I didn't, Strike confided.